Hello, everybody. This is JVL here with my best friend, Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark.
Hey, JVL.
Hey, best friend.
Hey, best friend.
How are you?
I'm good as a human. I'm a little nervous about things, just a smidge. I would say that we're a couple days late, so all the hot takes have been taken. But that debate did nothing to reassure those of us in our position who are deeply concerned about Bernie Sanders being the nominee that Mike Bloomberg was of sufficient capabilities to take, besides lots of advertising, but just in terms of like sheer political capability of putting a stop to his momentum.
I mean, in Bloomberg's defense, the way in which he was targeted over the first 45 minutes was unlike anything any candidate has received thus far this cycle. It was a full proctological exam with five very good candidates all beating the crap out of him, and the moderators too.
I wouldn't count that. Here's the thing. These guys, I thought he deserved everything he got.
This is not a moral judgment.
And I find Bloomberg to be one of the more palatable alternatives to a Bernie Trump showdown. But you know, these guys have been sweating their sheer fairness. These guys have been sweating their guts out all over Iowa and New Hampshire for this guy to waltz in at the 11th hour, drop $400 million. Which is fair. I don't think he's buying an election. I think he's buying media time. But he deserved that proctology exam. Yeah. They all deserve their. They've spread their licks on each other out over the course of the last 6 months, and so he got it all at once. But it's what he deserved. What do you think? I actually thought, for a guy with endless resources who can buy himself a lot of debate prep, that he seemed woefully underprepared for what was obviously going to be an onslaught.
He looked like he was going to wing it, basically. I thought his stop and frisk answer was good, or as good as you can do. Mm. And it may not be truthful. I do not follow New York politics closely. My friends who do told me what he said was a crock of shit. But that's not the point of whether it's true or not. It was just like, does it work as a, basically, it passes the smell test justification? But that was fine. The place where he seemed to be totally blindsided was the NDA stuff.
Right.
Which shocks me, because that should have been like the fourth thing he worried about.
Yeah.
Right?
And not even the fourth. I mean, like,
maybe the second.
Maybe
it should have been stop and frisk first, buying your way into the election second. I thought his you're buying your way into the election, it was also good. It was like, look, I worked really hard. I made a lot of money. I'm really proud of it. And I'm at the stage of my life where I want to give it all away in service of beating Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good answer.
It's a good answer, but one that I thought, I mean, I think part of the issue is skill thing as much as anything else. But, you know, he had to come in there and go on offense. And he spent the entire time on defense. And yes, they were all coming at him, but there are ways to handle that. Bernie Sanders is very good at going on offense. Bernie Sanders is a guy who takes whatever questions comes to him, gives you one line of an answer, and then pivots to his message. And the fact that I would just say is, if you're Mike Bloomberg and you really want this and you're coming in halfway through, you have to have a satisfying steer ability for people to say, you know, NDAs, and for him to be able to be like, yeah, you know who else has a lot of NDAs? Donald Trump. And let me tell you how I'm going to beat him. I'm like, I don't know what, however you do it, but like, he needed to get to the place of, I'm going to defeat Donald Trump, and you need a son of a bitch like me to do it, every single answer. And that's not what he did.
I agree. That said, he wasn't as bad as I expected him to be.
Is that right? Oh, he was so much worse than I thought he'd be.
I expected worse from him, because he never impressed me as a politician when he was mayor, as a particularly adept guy. Maybe I just set my bar too low and he cleared it, sort of. We'll see.
I thought, you know, one of the things that I think is, it makes a difference, right? The sheer talent of somebody to sort of speak clearly and make their case without a lot of chewing on their words and sort of reaching around for things. And I think it's what gives Pete and Bernie and Warren an edge over some of these guys when they're just on the stage, because I think you have with Amy and then Biden, and then Bloomberg was also in this camp, like just a real inability to find a clarity of message as they're, I mean, it's unclear whether Biden's is sort of attached in some ways to his stutter or whether it has to do with mental acuity eroding at his age. Advanced age. But I thought that Bloomberg just really didn't have that sort of crisp, I'm capable of really getting up here and just like charging into my message, which I understand what you're saying, that maybe he never impressed you there. But I mean, for somebody who's, part of the reason Donald Trump is even good at it is it's part of what he does all the time, right? He's like, he knows his shtick, he knows who he is, and he knows how to just like push forward into it. And I thought Bloomberg might have some of that natural talent, having been in politics and business for a long time. But no.
Well, that's because he's a real businessman and not a pretend reality TV businessman. Yeah. Right. I mean, this is the difference is that Donald Trump's like ability to bullshit is not the ability that he picked up in business. That's the ability he picked up on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't know. I mean, the thing, to be honest, the thing that worries me most about Bloomberg is that he does not seem to understand the position he is currently in, which, and we talked about a little bit about this on Charlie's show, which is that if he doesn't, Tim, our buddy Tim Miller, put this perfectly. Bloomberg does not seem to understand that finishing with a gentleman's 18% is the same thing as handing Sanders the nomination.
Right.
And the one thing that he has the ability to do right now is drop $400 million on Sanders' head over the next week and a half and drive Sanders' numbers down all across the Super Tuesday states. He'd be crazy not to do it. And I get the sense that he and his team have talked themselves into thinking that they don't need to do it, that they need a heads-up one-on-one showdown with Sanders down the stretch, which really begins after Super Tuesday. And that might be a way to hold Sanders under 50% if you go all the way to the convention, but it's not the way to deny him the nomination.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that they are laying off right now because they think, yeah, let him win Nevada. They want him to win Nevada.
Yeah.
They want him to win South Carolina because they want him to be the definitive front runner so that Bloomberg can sweep in and go mano a mano with Bernie. And what's complicating things for him is that Pete and Amy have been overperforming in the last couple of states. Biden on life support, but hanging in there and still on track to potentially win South Carolina in a deflated way, but still there. And so I just like if he was smart, but if he were really in it for the good of all, he wouldn't wait. He would go for Sanders now to the benefit of the entire field.
Yep.
And I think and every day that he doesn't do that, the angrier I become. Not the litmus test for any politician, but just between you and I, it is the angrier I become at him.
Speaking of anger.
Yeah.
The Pete Amy stuff, which happened in the debate, not once, but twice, was amazing. And one of the most human things I've ever seen on a debate stage from her side, not from his, because mm-hmm. he's a robot. He's like the Terminator who's come back from the future to win a nomination.
And he's not a robot. He's just unflappable. He's just good.
And I sat there, and the only thing I could think of watching it was, oh my gosh, what is Sarah thinking right now? Because it's mommy and daddy are fighting.
That's right. I think I tweeted.
Whose side were you on? Oh, you tweeted something. I didn't see that.
I know.
I'm not
didn't.
On Twitter.
Don't do this, you two. Stop. I have mixed feelings about this, so we'll work through it. I would say in binary choices being what they are, I come down on Pete's side, which I bet surprises you.
That does surprise
yeah.
me.
Yeah, and here's
the survivor
thing.
Theory is the strongest viable woman.
I knew you were gonna. I was gonna say that, right? My survivor theory is the most viable woman. That's not Elizabeth Warren in this case, because I'm like,
she is not viable.
No, and here's this is, but part of it is that I am rooting for Amy. And so I want to see her at her best. And I didn't think that was her best. I actually thought what we saw.
Really?
Yeah. So
I thought she was right on the merits on both of them.
So here's the thing. I thought it diminished both of them. And this is why I hated it. Because he looked like the little pissant. I'm smarter than everybody else. I'm going to try to hang you up on what is obviously like I mean, how many times during a podcast am I like, I've just lost my train of thought. What are we talking about? Like, it's a human thing to do. And
it's meaningless. It is a meaningless piece of media gotcha, which happens every year to some unlucky candidate and drives me crazy.
So I thought it was a bad look for him to not once but twice kind of turn his body to her at the podium and go at her. Now, a lot of my reasons for disliking it, though, are strategic, because they should, if they were trying to get any other project done, they would be looking at each other, understanding that they were each other's life raft and that they had to join forces to take out the other guys. But instead, they think they need to kill each other for supremacy. And so I didn't love either of them. But here's the thing. Here's why in the draw, I'd give it to Pete. Pete never lost his temper. So, yes, he went too far. And I think it was not being sort of well received by the audience. It did seem like a cheap shot. But she did lose her cool. And when she started waving her arms.
Wait, I'm sorry. Amy Klobuchar lost her cool.
So this is the thing, is that like.
I don't believe it.
I
thought she was this calm presence. She was always zen.
But there's a way to be a fighter. I didn't like any of her lines. Like when she said, "Are you calling me stupid, Pete? Are you saying I'm dumb?" I think that hurt him, but I also felt like it hurt her. I thought it was a little bit playing the victim. I didn't think it made her look statesmanlike. I thought in the second exchange, I'm not sure which exchange it was, when she really got heated and she kind of started waving her arms and coming out over the podium.
I wish we were all as perfect as you, Pete.
The reason I give it to him is because he did all of that. Some of it was
Spanish.
A bad look.
It was the Spanish.
Oh, God. So that was the funniest part of your piece when you just said, and then Pete started speaking Spanish. I mean, when he does that stuff, it's just like, hey, man, that extra 20% takes you from like really knocking out of the park to now you've like reverted back the other way and you suck. I hated the speaking in Spanish. It is so annoying. Not because I think that people shouldn't speak in Spanish to demonstrate to certain audiences that
it's because it's showing off
yes. And it looks stupid. But he got her goat. She let him get it. And so I was disappointed that the level at which her responses seemed stuck were this to like kind of play the victim. Oh, you're so perfect. And it was also like it had that edge. Of like,
what kind of edge are you talking about?
It was nasty.
Did you think she was going to throw her briefing book at him? Because I did.
It looked. I mean, that's the thing. This is what's so you can't read on Pete. If he hates her, you can't tell.
He hates everybody and everything. He's a Terminator.
That's not true.
He has no human emotions.
He has lots of hope, and just lay off Pete for a second. Amy looked like. You're like, oh, I'm not, she can't, like, she's not controlling herself. She is, like, she hates him, and it's all over her face. And I thought that was really bad. Even if it's justified.
It was awesome.
Yeah, I didn't think it was awesome. I wanted them to stop fighting. I think that there's a the temperament question, really, when it's just rumors, that's one thing. But when you start to see it, and you see the flashes of like how angry she can get. And because what you want is you want somebody who's got that perfect smooth response that cuts somebody down just in half. And, oh, I wish everybody could be perfect like you, Pete, is not that answer.
No. That is somebody who has nothing in the quiver.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
You've just resorted to sarcasm.
Yeah.
You don't have something better. Yeah. No, I agree. Funny enough, I thought Pete was the most effective critic of Sanders. I thought he was the only one on stage who seemed to understand that he needed. But this is why I was disappointed in his decision to go after Klobuchar.
Agreed.
Because what is that? He should have understood that in the same way he stole a lot of Biden voters by going after Warren, you're going to steal Klobuchar voters not by going after her, but by going after Sanders.
Right.
Right. Prove that you're more viable. Prove that you can take him apart better than she can.
Yep.
And it struck me as one of those things where he literally couldn't help himself because he's programmed to kill on stage. And so when, you know, it's like when you're playing one of those video games where you've got a light gun and you shoot, and like people start coming on stage, but sometimes they're innocent people and like you lose a life if you shoot them.
Duck Hunt was the last shooting game I played, so.
So Pete just can't, hell, he's got to shoot everybody because he can do it. You know,
Maybe. I mean, in the first half of the debate, he was really killing it because I was like, this is a good strategy, Pete. You came in. Bernie Sanders is the burn it all down candidate. Mike Bloomberg is the buy this election candidate. You are sitting there in the middle. That is your pitch. I love it.
Yep.
And then
talking about inclusion.
It was great. And then weirdly, he decided in the second half, after he had landed some very effective shots on Sanders and was the only one besides Bloomberg who then later in the second half finally got some in. It was one thing the first time he did the Amy thing and I was like, that didn't really work for you, but like, you're fine, you're having a good debate. So when he went in for it the second time, I was like, why? Who told you strategically that you had to go just like all the way in on Amy? Like, take your one shot at her and then go after somebody else.
It's a very, very weird thing.
But, you know, they just can't help it. I mean, we saw this happen with the Republicans. It's happening right now with the Democrats. They cannot help themselves. And it's like, you know, Elizabeth Warren didn't feel the need to go after Bernie. She took the foil of Mike Bloomberg, shook it down for all it was worth, got herself probably back in the hunt a little bit, not for real, but like recertified herself as a real progressive and like reminded people of why they were for her. Because that's what you do. You go after the one that recertifies you with the people you're trying to reach. You don't just try to compete with the person who's in your lane.
Can I throw out a hot take for you?
I want the hotter the better.
Biden should drop out. And he and Obama should hit the campaign trail for Pete in South Carolina. The way to stop Bernie. And I actually think that it's entirely possible that Biden winds up as a stronger contender than Pete. But the problem is that to wait to find that out, you've got to wait too long to find that out. We don't want to wait that long.
Why? What would his incentive be to do that when the one place that Biden has a shot of resuscitating his campaign, his only option, is to win South Carolina? And it's the one place where he still has a chance to win.
The only reason to do it is patriotism. The only reason is patriotism. To decide that we, and a love of the Democratic Party, that this party that I love, the Democratic Party, we are not going to let it be taken over by a hostile entity the way the Republicans did. This is the party of Barack Obama, not the party of Bernie Sanders. And we're going to go out and we're going to try to transfer all of the goodwill I have to this guy who is essentially starting from zero with the black community. And I'm going to try to do for him what the Kennedy family did for Obama in 2007.
Why Pete and not Amy? Just because he's ahead in delegate counts? He's more plausible?
Also because he's the argument for him then is the change election, right? It's not, I mean, Amy's is just like, I'm not scary, right? Her pitch is, I'm not a scary person.
Scared me the other night.
Pete's is, we're turning the page on all of this stuff. Yeah. Like, this is the time to pass the torch to a new generation. And that contrast with Sanders is very good. I just don't see any way that even in a heads-up race, Klobuchar could beat Sanders. And even if they did this, it might not be enough to beat Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
He's got his bot army. You know, everybody, we've talked about this a little bit, about how, like, oh, he's got this rabid core of, like, really mean people online, and isn't that terrible? I think it's an asset. It's a tremendous asset to have a bunch of terrible people who are willing to do awful things on your behalf. It's not good.
It's not good.
But it's very, very helpful. And I think
well,
that
this
is the future of
politics. Well, it's also helpful
to
have an armed militia that walks behind you and shoots dissenters.
Yes, it is. It's very helpful. But this is politics as it exists now. And the only way to combat something like that is to create your own movement. And who else could plausibly create a movement at this point?
Hey, you know, I like your hot take because I think it introduces an interesting piece that's like not on the radar exactly, but that is absolutely in play, which is when does Obama put his thumb on the scale?
He won't.
Absolutely. But why not? Why, you just made a pitch for patriotism and party.
Yeah, no, this is
and
what
so doesn't he cares about that? You don't think he cares enough about it?
No. I think he cares about Barack Obama, right? And he, I mean, he ought to care because he is out there being Barack Obama in a way that George W. Bush is not. And if he is made persona non grata in the Democratic Party, I think he'll feel that.
Yeah. Do you think Bernie would sort of run against Obama?
He's been doing it already.
Does he?
Yeah. Talks all the time about what a terrible, how awful things were in from 2008 from forever to yesterday. Things have been terrible, right? For Bernie, there was no golden period where it was better. Things have always been unbelievably terrible.
Right.
And this is an implicit and occasionally hinges into explicit criticism of the Obama years.
That's interesting. Well, I will tell you, I saw the best version of Joe Biden I'd ever seen the other night.
He was good, right?
He was great.
He had a very good debate.
And I didn't understand. Maybe it's just because he was able to go on offense for the first time because he wasn't, you know, running at the top of the pack.
He didn't have everybody ganging on him.
But I was sort of like...
It's easy to do a debate when you don't have everybody taking shots at you, as Bernie Sanders has learned over the course of these many, many months.
Yeah, and as he unfortunately still basically gets to learn. I mean, I thought your piece was really good about the fact that he is not being vetted and they are not asking him tough questions. And, like, you see things pop up on Twitter, but, like, nobody's really going at him over all... I mean, not just his history. Like, okay, he honeymooned in... Russia, USSR. That's weird. It's not where most people honeymoon. He did it because he feels an actual fidelity and connection to the politics of 1980s Russia. And that's totally bizarre. But, like, ostensibly he could renounce that and rehabilitate. But some of the things, you tell the story about the Iranian hostages, when she said we're CIA plants and should be just left there. Like, this stuff is crazy. And this is the thing that people don't understand from a vetting perspective. Donald Trump's patriotism is fake, and it is actually not patriotism. It's nationalism. It's performative. It's about yelling at black people who decide to kneel to, you know, protest racial justice and wave the flag. But lots of people buy it from Trump. He loves this country. All right. It's stupid. But lots of people buy it. When they'll really buy it is when the alternative is somebody. The thing about Bernie's worldview is that it has always been a rejection of America, its experiment, it's what it's trying to do, who we are. It is a constant criticism. And I don't think that Democrats realize it's not just that he liked Stalin or that he was a Trotskyite who, you know, talked about, I can't remember his name, Cuba.
Castro,
that he praised Castro, that he praised breadlines. It's not just that. It's that he feels fundamentally un-American in a way that will make a difference in that general election.
Well, the explanation of this is that his worldview is solidarity with workers, right? I mean, this is the literal socialist worldview, which is that what is important are not the arbitrary lines that we have drawn marking one country off for another. And marking one set of oligarchs off from another. What matters are the class lines, which are created by who holds the capital.
Right.
And this is his genuine view of the world. And so it isn't anti-American in the sense that it's just anti the system, and the system is everywhere, right? And he rejects all of that and believes that everywhere, in all places, whether it be at Denmark or the Soviet Union or in America, it ought to be the workers versus the powerful entrenched interests. But
must they always be at war? Because in his view, right, and this is, I think, a pretty central question to capitalism versus socialism, is in his view, right, you always have class warfare. It is both what animates you, and it's like the state that you exist in, versus capitalism, which, for all of its faults, 2.5 cheers for capitalism, is about... it is the way that we disperse capital, and there is the ability for everybody to gain capital, and it is not meant to set up, we've moved too far in this direction right now, but it is not meant to set up people being at war with one another.
Well, once we've liquidated the kulaks, then I'm sure we'll have peace.
Sure.
No, it is, but it is always war, right? I mean, it's a the class struggle is a permanent struggle. There is no, and again, this is going to sound like I am half in sympathy with the class struggle, actually. And but it is sort of eternal when you look at it the way he does, because in the dialectic of history, there are always people who have, right? I mean, true socialism has never been tried.
Sure.
Right? I mean, we never get all the way to the perfect socialist workers' utopia so that we can know whether or not it really works, right? We always like, oh, well, okay, so it didn't work over there, but that's because they didn't do X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And but this is the nature of everything. This is why if Trump were to lose to him, the problem won't be Trump. Right. But well, true Trumpism was never tried. The problem was that the media was against us and the Jews and the never Trumpers. And we just got to butch up around Don Jr. next time and stand up. We got to make sure OANN kills Fox News because Fox News was insufficiently loyal to the president and blah, 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 blah. Like this is how all human animals act. And it's why we're doomed. It's why there is no future that is good for us. There.
So hey. I see you're in a great mood today.
This is a good. I'm so much better mood than I was like yesterday. I was way darker yesterday.
I was also in a bad mood yesterday. I'm deeply concerned about. I don't know what we're gonna do. You know, there's like the big picture concerns for the country, for the world. The state of democracy and its fragility around the world. If you are looking at a Bernie Sanders Donald Trump showdown, great for Putin, bad for democracy. Also, though, it brings us and our particular position politically into this incredibly annoying space where for the next 8 months, we're literally going to just be given never Trump litmus tests all day long about whether or not we are never Trump enough to support the socialist who is, for me, as far as I get, like as far from me as I could get politically. You, there's like places where you guys can overlap. For me, I am, Bernie is the antithesis, both in content and in form of what I would like to see out of a politician. And I just, it just makes me, I like hate to think about what the next however many months looks like while we live in a world where Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are battling for the presidency.
Well, I mean, I have a couple things. I have some good news and some bad news for you. Let me give you the good news first.
Great.
The good news is that I have been reliably informed by Hugh Hewitt that you can vote for Bernie Sanders and still be a great patriotic American, so long as you can create some bizarre chain of reasoning which allows you to say that your vote is really about something else, then there's no problem with voting for Bernie and still being a conservative. So there you have that.
That is not what I would consider to be good, actionable good news, but go ahead.
The bad now news. The bad is, news. What if this is as good as it gets? So you think Trump versus Bernie is bad? What if the next one of these that we do is Don Jr. versus AOC? Because you could say what you want about Donald Trump. Donald Trump Jr. is him minus another 15 IQ points. And you can say what you want about Bernie, but AOC is way stupider than he is. What if this... what we're seeing right now is not some crazy black swan, but is the beginning of the new political paradigm that's going to last for the next generation in American politics. Boom.
Yeah.
Mic drop.
That's great. Here's my answer to that. My answer to that is that there's a weird silver lining that I see with Bernie Sanders being the nominee. And it is that for the first time in certainly our lifetime, but I'm not sure how far back you'd have to go to find the largest number of disaffected voters hanging out in sort of the normal space, the non-burn-it-all-down lane, the pro-democracy, capitalism is better than other forms people. And you talk when you talk like that, it is as though we have no ability to impact what that future looks like.
But when
I hear, that's not true. This is where you and I don't agree. If it is Bernie Sanders, I will throw myself into that middle space. I will pick up whatever mantle is available, grab whatever people on both sides I can, and lead a centrist insurrection to guard against these limitless extremes that we now find polarizing the country.
So the problem with that is that the way it used to be was that when parties died in America, they blew up and something new could grow up where they stood.
Yeah.
And we no longer have that. We have zombie parties.
We do have zombie parties, but they can be put through a stick through the head.
Can they?
Kill them for good.
How?
Okay, well, new parties. I mean, because one of the things that's happening, but Bill makes this observation, and I think it's a good one, which is that to have Bernie Sanders and Trump is like European-style politics without the multiple parties
right.
that allow you to have the centrist
exactly
party.
Correct. That's
and
exactly
so,
correct.
For me, I think that the opportunity to build a sort of center must hold coalition in a Bernie Sanders Trump, it's such a stark choice of the extremes that there really is the first time opportunity for people to coalesce around the notion essentially of reinvesting in liberal democracy as
so
a concept.
How do you do that mechanically? Like how did Macron do this in France? Do you need a single guy at the top to run as your president and then a bunch of people run underneath him? Do you start at the congressional level? Like where do you start with that project?
I assume
it means you need a ton of money.
You do need a ton of money, but this is why sort of Bernie makes some of this stuff possible is how much of like, so there's plenty of individuals who are willing to give Bernie money that he has a populist appeal. Democratic donors are looking for a new world, right? I mean, these guys don't want, they're not doing anything to stop him right now, which I think is a huge mistake. But I think that there is an entire world of center-right, center-left donors who are like, okay, this is not, especially if Bernie wins and you're looking at a pendulum that swings back and forth between, as you put it, people like Donald Trump and Don Jr. and Bernie Sanders and AOC, there is a reason for capital investments in the center, if for no other reason than to protect economic stability in the country.
The people on the left don't just throw in their lot with Bernie the way the people on the right did with Trump.
No, and I'll tell you the reason why. I think that the big difference and the reason that Donald Trump has remained is that Donald Trump has a really good economy that he's sitting on top of. And that has calmed everybody down. He was able to give them one thing that they really like, which is tax cuts for their businesses that allows them to operate and grow and purchases a lot of looking the other way on the shredding of democratic norms, crapping on the rule of law, etc. Bernie doesn't have those things to give to those donors, right? Bernie, I mean, maybe because here's the thing, he can talk like he wants to do a lot on the environment. He can talk like he wants to, you know, he's going to make lots of billionaires pay their fair share, which is, I mean, these people are probably like, okay, yeah, I'll pay more in taxes or whatever. But there's a $24 trillion debt. We've tapped out on a $1 trillion deficit. We don't have a lot of money for big social programs. The economy is riding on the sugar high, and the extent to which it can potentially crash the second that the market loses confidence, that now we've got a socialist running things, like the opportunities for things to get upside down on us really fast in terms of markets and everything else. I think you see the money in the tech industry that thrives on innovation and needs, and all of the other companies that need stability to thrive. I think people start looking around for new options. And so the opportunity is not just the money or the donors. The opportunity is that there is a gaping space now where you can really make a case for a third party. And just to answer your bigger question, though, on chicken or egg, leadership or people, I do think you'll need leaders. I do think you'll need people who make the case. And it will sound different from every case that's been made in the last 20 or 30 years, because those cases have been made on negative polarity. We are better than these other guys. That's why you see the chasm widening and widening, because you can move to extremes when you need to. What you're doing is always drawing just negative contrast to people. You'd have to affirmatively be for something to run up the center. But that thing can be liberal democracy. It still matters to a lot of people.
That's
tell me I'm wrong.
I know. You're not wrong, probably. But one of the things that I find very interesting about the moment we're in is that all of this radical burn-it-down change has come at a time of tremendous prosperity and relative peace.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have often wondered, what happens the next time the world blows up? Because it'll happen, right? There's always, the world always blows up sometime, right? The next 9/11, the next housing bubble crash or something. If we are already at DEFCON 1 in terms of burning down our institutions because we think they've failed us now, what's it going to be like then? And I don't know. I think that's terrifying.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, I am like the last person, the last remaining person who worries about the debt. But I worry about it because to me it is an actual national security risk. Because the next time there is a massive downturn, like the idea that this is just sustainable and that you can do it forever. I mean, even the way that people talk about Trump's economy, the fact is people feel good in this economy. They felt good in 2007 in that economy. These things can fall apart so fast. They are those bubbles that were there in 2007, they are there again. But we've racked up so much more debt in the last decade. We don't have money to do big infrastructure projects. We don't have money to solve climate change. And the time when you invest in paying down that debt are times right now, big, prosperous times. That's not what's happening. Nobody is providing any leadership, providing any forethought.
I have a friend who lives in Arlington, one of the suburbs of Virginia, a very well-to-do suburb, who was telling me that there was a house on her street that went up for sale, a little 1950s, two-bedroom cottage type thing. It went up for sale. The asking price was $850.
Mm-hmm.
And it was multiple cash offers before the listing was formal,
mm-hmm.
with no inspections, no nothing, just so that people could tear it down and build something new there.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought to myself, I remember this. This happened already. This is what a bubble looks like. Because that's not a rational thing.
Right.
Yeah. But I don't know. Maybe if you print enough money, right, irrationality can go on for forever. I don't know. I wish I had the answer because none of the things that I thought I understood about economics have turned out to be true. Like, there is no inflation somehow when there should be, right? By all accounts, the inflation genie should have been out of the bottle at some point over the last 5 years, and it hasn't happened.
But what if it all happens at once? What if we've been papering things over and keeping this patient,
if that happens, then whoever is sitting, whatever party is sitting on the throne at that time will be discredited for a generation.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it will be like Herbert Hoover, I think. Maybe not.
Well, anyway, for those of you listening, here's my rally cry for the center.
All right. What should we banter about?
Hey, have you seen Parasite?
I've seen parts of Parasite. Have you seen Parasite? Do you love it?
I did.
Did you just love it?
Did I love it? I liked it very much. I haven't seen 1917, so there's no way to compare. I will say this about
Parasite. There's only one female character in 1917. You wouldn't like it.
okay. It was funny watching Trump sort of do his little riff at his whatever, and obviously I don't watch his rallies, but I caught whatever that clip was where he was like, what about Gone with the Wind? What was his second one?
There was
one?
A movie. Yeah, but, I don't remember. What was it?
I don't know, but it was also something that I would say like was of relatively good taste. There's a lot of people who are like criticizing the Gone with the Wind thing, being like, oh, he just likes his racist movies or whatever, but obviously Gone with the Wind is like a classic.
It's a great movie.
Whatever the second one was is also a great movie that he said. And I actually was like, you haven't seen Gone with the Wind. You were too busy doing like Bad Boys 2 or whatever, or porn or whatever it is he watches.
The Gorilla Channel. He just watches reality television.
Watches
porn.
Fox News.
Yeah.
But Parasite, not to extend the metaphor of its title, but it has burrowed into my brain and I have been like unpacking it. For days.
It's a very Bernie-esque movie, isn't it?
But I just don't understand. You only saw pieces of it, and...
I'll explain to you some other time.
Okay. Well, I don't know how to talk to you about it then, because I definitely don't want to do spoilers.
I know quite a lot about it.
So I'm just going to tell you one thing about it. That
also, spoilers don't bother me.
Okay.
Spoilers have no effect on me.
That's so weird. That makes me crazy. I mean, I don't think people can like spoil things that have been out for 20 years, but like this is a movie that lots of people could still just watch on Netflix. And you should go watch it. It's different than most of the things that you see. It's about South Korea, so I found the cultural stuff really interesting, both in terms of how similar it is to the West and also, you know, the, some of the differences.
Keeping people in their basements, for instance.
Well, that's not quite what was happening. But to me, the thing that was the most interesting, so there's this, the everything that, that happens and what culminates as the sort of end thing is all about class resentment, mm-hmm. right? But the thing is, the way that that manifests throughout the movie through discussions about sort of olfactory, like it's all about smells. I just had never quite seen anything like it where, I'm going to talk about it in some detail, but you've got the kid trying to put together, there's four people now working for this family, and the family doesn't know that the people working for them are in fact all a family themselves.
Correct.
And so one of the things that the kid says early on, just out loud, is that he smells the daughter or something, or smells the dad, and says, "You smell like she smells, and also this other person smells that way." And but at that point, he's not necessarily a negative statement, it's just that they all smell similarly. But through the course of the movie, there's a lot of discussion both that's actually, they're not supposed to be hearing it, but they do, about how they smell. And that is ultimately the trigger for sort of the main, the, what is it? The
violence.
The
horror.
I'm looking for that French term that means, not pièce de résistance, maybe whatever it is. You know, the
denouement.
Denouement, thank you. At the end, when the sort of rich dad, he sees him like recoil at the smell of the guy as he's trying to get his car keys. To me, that was like, I just like something interesting and new that I like thought was potent as a mechanism.
Into a Bernie Sanders voter yet?
Why?
It's all the class resentments.
Yeah, but I thought that what was interesting about it is how deeply personal that would be, right? To be being told.
That's what corporate America is telling you every day.
That they're telling people they smell.
Yeah.
That's why they sell them soaps and whatever.
That's right.
No. I just the other thing I liked about it was they're sort of like a, you're not sure who the bad guy is, right? Is it these rich people who don't really treat people great, or sort of,
or the murderers?
Or the murderers, right?
Who can say who the real bad guy is?
Well, you know, so this family's like burrowing into the other family, but they're actually doing it because they really want jobs. There's no evidence that they're not working hard or that they're doing a bad job. They desperately need jobs, and so they're all trying to help each other as a family sort of get these jobs. I don't know. It's just been like sitting with me in a way that lots of other movies haven't for a while.
So we're going to get out of here in 30 seconds. My wife downloaded the audiobook of Little Teensy Weensy Eensy Beensy Women
mm-hmm.
the other day.
Yeah.
And we got into bed and she turned it on. And I, as God is my witness, I tried listening to the first bit. It was the most boring opening of any book I have ever heard in my life.
Okay.
Like, when you start a book, you gotta like grab the reader and like, you know, pull them into this world. And it's just, I was asleep in 5 minutes.
Well, maybe that's because it was nighttime.
Yeah,
I don't believe,
maybe that's what it was.
I don't think that this is Little Women's fault. All right. You, first of all, also, the book is written, I think I read that book when I was 13. So maybe. When I read books now that I read when I was 13 that I thought were amazing, I often find that they don't quite satisfy the 39-year-old. However, you should see the movie. You should see the 1990s version with Claire Danes.
And Winona Ryder.
Winona Ryder.
I love Winona Ryder.
Yeah, amazing. And a young Kirsten Dunst, who plays Amy. A Susan Sarandon is the mom.
Love me some Kirsten Dunst, too.
What's his name? For some... See, I sympathize with Amy Klobuchar. not Heath Ledger, the other, oh, Christian Bale, the other hot guy that confused me a great deal as a teenager because I was so in love with Christian Bale.
Who wouldn't be?
Yeah, well, Newsies was formative for me as well.
Bye, guys.